You're listening to my radio at stanpelke.com. This is Stan Pelke, and I am so pleased you've joined me for the 14th podcast featuring the second half of Chapter 7 from my original novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. This is a milestone for me, because with the completion of Chapter 7, we've reached the end of what I had conceived of as the first section of the novel. The great news is that I have already written the majority of the next part of the novel, so production on the podcasts will continue. Most importantly, I am very happy with the response I have received so far to the novel and the podcasts. If you are enjoying these episodes, would you consider telling others about them? I would be thrilled to see the audience continue to grow. As always, please visit the rest of my website for reviews and essays, as well as an upcoming bonus music podcast. After lunch, Sherman headed back out into the north side fields. Thea began to wash the dishes, and Widow Jackson returned to the canning after settling Grandpa in an old armchair in the front corner of the kitchen, facing the road. They had moved the chair there so Grandpa could snooze by the window in the late afternoon while the women worked in the kitchen. Charlie went out to check on the hobos. "We're all getting back to work now," Charlie said to them. "Lots to do today to keep the farm going. You're welcome to sleep in the loft in the barn tonight, and I'll see that you have a small breakfast in the morning, but you'll have to move on after that."
Very kind, I'm sure. But surely, young man, we could be two more sets of strong hands for your farm's needs. I worked on automobile engines before. Perhaps you have an old tractor I could work on with you. Or we'd be happy to harvest some of those fine vegetables in the garden out front. My companion has worked on many apple orchards and is not unacquainted with berry patches. We could stay for several days and lend a hand.
Charlie shook his head slowly. I appreciate the offer, but we're barely making ends meet. More hands also means more mouths to feed, and I need to save as much of the produce as possible to sell. Like I said, I can offer you a place to sleep tonight and breakfast tomorrow, but you'll need to be on your way after that. Charlie did not wait for the man to answer, but headed back out into the cornfield to help Sherman with the afternoon weeding and watering. The afternoon was wearing on, and Charlie could feel the back of his neck burning in the sunlight, despite the large-brimmed hat he was wearing. "Damn, Sherm, it's hot today. What about a quick break for some iced tea?" There was no answer. Charlie sighed and tossed his spade aside, pulled one more handful of weeds from along the base of the nearest cornstalk, then rose and began to look this way and that for his friend. He was sure Sherman had been close by a few minutes ago, but now he was nowhere to be seen. Charlie wiped his brow and then headed back toward the house for a drink. The two hobos were lounging peacefully in the shade beside the barn. They did not even bother to look up as Charlie walked past them. Charlie turned toward the house, but then stopped as he heard a muffled laugh coming from behind the woodshed that stood about 40 feet from the barn. Charlie headed quickly over to the woodshed, turned the corner, and almost ran into Sherman and Thea. Sherman was leaning casually against the wall of the woodshed, his left leg bent, so his foot was on the wall and his knee was sticking out in front of him. Thea was resting with her right side against Sherman's chest and left leg, one arm flung around his neck, the other inside his unbuttoned shirt. One of his arms was supporting the small of her back, while the other had slid up her leg and was approaching the hem of her dress. "What the heck's going on?" Charlie snapped. Thea gasped, pulled free of Sherman, and ran toward the house. Sherman, what the hell are you thinking? Mind your own damn business, Charlesy. This is my business. I have a household to keep together. Fred's a sap, Charlesy, and Thea's sick of him. She wants a real man beside her. Running around with girls who have boyfriends is one thing, Sherm, but a married woman is completely different. You, of all people, shouldn't be doing this. She tain't the first, Sherman said, beginning to laugh. I don't even want to know. Sherman sighed and threw a hand onto Charlie's shoulder. Come on, Charlesy. You've got Gloria Jane. I'm lonely. Really lonely. You gotta understand that. Besides, no one's gotta know. Fred's gone for at least another week and— Are you kidding? And then what? Really, Sherm, then what? This has to stop, now. I can't risk violence between you and Fred, not when you're living together under my roof. No worries, Charlesy. Fred don't have t in him. Sherman began to walk away, buttoning his shirt back up as he went. But Charlie grabbed his arm and pulled him back hard against the wall of the woodshed. I mean it, Sherm. I really do. I won't risk the income they bring to the farm. To hell with the farm, Sherman yelled, pushing Charlie's arm away and heading toward the driveway. We're through! Don't you get that? Sherman stopped suddenly in the middle of the driveway, turned, and looked straight into Charlie's face. We've been through for months. Don't you know it? It tain't gonna work no more. No amount of canned goods is gonna save us now. He turned around again and stormed off toward the road. Where are you going, Sherm? None of your damn business, Charlesy boy, Sherman yelled, this time without looking back. At the end of the driveway, Sherman turned left toward town. Charlie knew what that meant. Sherman was heading to the Flanagan. All the hard work, all the sober months, were about to come to an end. Charlie swore and ran after his best friend. Wait, Sherman, wait, please! Sherman kept walking. Charlie ran until he caught up to him. I get that you're mad at me, Sherm, but don't head into town like this. I'll tell Thea and Fred that they have to move on. I just don't go drinking. Sherman stopped and turned to look at Charlie. Sod off, I'm done. I tried it your way and your grandpa's way. It tain't made a difference. I'm still as poor as ever. I'm still without a woman. I'm sick of being dry, too. I've had it, and I won't be back, Charlesy. He stormed off again and did not look back. Charlie stood in the middle of the road, frozen in place by despair. The evening meal was even more quiet than usual. Thea had hidden herself away in her room and refused to come out. Widow Jackson was muttering under her breath as she finished the preparations for supper. Grandpa did not know what had happened, but he must have sensed it as he snoozed fitfully in the chair by the window. Charlie paced back and forth along the length of the kitchen, stopping each time as he approached the front side of the house to look out the window for Sherman. But there was no sign of him returning for dinner. Widow Jackson finally put the small chicken on the table, along with more bread and some lettuce. Charlie carved some of the breast and a leg off the bird and prepared a plate for the two guests in the barn. I'll be right back, he said softly to Widow Jackson. She nodded and went to get Grandpa Spear from his chair as Charlie headed out to the barn. The sun had set, and Widow Jackson had made her way back down the road to her small house between the Spears farm and Miller's Bend. Charlie had sat quietly all evening at the kitchen table studying the bills and trying to decide his next course of action to meet their financial obligations. Every few minutes he would get up and look down the road for some sign of Sherman, but the road remained empty. Grandpa was curled up on the sofa where he often slept in the summer, the lights in the parlor now turned off, and Charlie saw that the light in the barn was off too. He walked out onto the screened-in back porch and made certain the screen door was latched for the night. Charlie hated to assume the worst about the two men in the barn, but he needed to protect what little they had to show for all their hard work, and there was a lot of canned food out there. He sighed, realizing he really needed to start moving all that food down to the basement in the morning. Charlie left the inner door between the porch and the kitchen open, however, both to get a better breeze into the kitchen and to keep an ear on things during the night. Then he went to the front closet, pulled out his cot, set it up about halfway between the front window and the porch door, and lay down. Sherm's right, he whispered. We can't go on. It's too little, too late. I've failed Grandpa. I've failed us all. He covered his face with his hands and willed himself to go to sleep. He needed his rest if he was going to tackle the fields by himself tomorrow. He woke with a start, shallow, quick breathing, his heart racing so furiously that his chest hurt and his temples throbbed with a sharp pain. In the darkness, disoriented, he reached for something, anything familiar, but felt nothing.
Talcortorin.
Sherm? Then Charlie heard the sound again, voices whispering in the screened-in back porch. He had left the small lamp in the foyer on, in case Sherman came home, and now by its light, Charlie could see that someone had carefully pulled the inner kitchen door closed, though not all the way. He thought he saw some figures moving out on the porch. He rose quickly and hurried toward the door, flipped the switch for the porch light, and pulled open the door. The two hobos he had welcomed for the night were in there. They had torn through the screen in the outer door in order to work the latch and get in, but they had been joined by a third man, very tall and stocky. All three men were stuffing jars of corn and beans into their sacks.
"What are you doing?"
Charlie yelled at the men as he stormed out onto the porch. They stared at him for a moment in stunned silence. Then the first man approached Charlie while the others went back to work, pulling jars from the carefully stacked piles.
"The world is full of haves and have-nots, my boy, and there's little rhyme nor reason as to who has and who has not. You've got plenty, my boy, and we're hungry. We offered to work for our keep, but you wouldn't hear it. So we're helping ourselves before we head back out under the rails."
"No, you're not. I know times are tough for all of us, but I can barely keep my own family together. I will not allow you to steal from me or from my grandpa. Put the jars back and then get out of here and on your way."
"That ain't friendly or fair, boy. We're going to take this, then we'll go."
He hoisted his bag onto his shoulder and began to head toward the outer door. Charlie stepped in front of him and put out his hand. "Put those things back." The newcomer, tall and stocky, suddenly pulled a knife from beneath his coat and brandished it at Charlie.
"Don't be a fool, boy," the first man said. "This stuff ain't worth a cut or two from my friend. Just let us go,"
he concluded with one of his earlier warm smiles. "No, not this time." The hobo lunged at him, but Charlie easily stepped aside and caught the man's right arm and shoulder and pushed him backward into one of the old wicker chairs. Then Charlie heard a loud clatter as the first man dropped his bag and rushed at him. The third man joined him, and they fell over in a heap, the man's fists pummeling Charlie's face. Blood began to run from his nose and a cut on his lip. Charlie fought back as best he could with the heavier men on top of him.
"Get out to way, and I'll give him a cut for being so unfriendly-like,"
the newcomer yelled as he picked up his bag and moved aggressively toward Charlie. The young man finally heaved the first hobo off him, knocked the second hard in the head until he rolled away, and rose to his feet. Charlie raised his fists as he waited for the man with the knife.
"You're a fool, boy. It's just a bit of food," the first hobo yelled.
Then the knife came at him with a flash. Charlie lifted his arms defensively and felt the blade bite his left forearm.
"Enough!" It was Sherman's voice. "The next one of you to move, I'll pop you in a kneecap!"
The combatants turned toward the kitchen door where Sherman stood, framed by the foyer light, and pointing one of Grandpa's old service revolvers at them.
"Whoa, young sir!"
the first hobo shouted.
"Don't shoot! It's just a few jars of food!
You take one each and then get out of here, now!"
Under Sherman's watchful eye and pistol, the three men emptied their bags of all but three jars, then fled out the door and into the dark night beyond. Sherman watched them disappear into the shadows beyond the barn, then pulled Charlie into the kitchen and settled him into a chair.
"I'm proud of you, Charlesy,"
Sherman said as he began to tend his friend's wounded arm. "It was stupid of me. Just for a few dollars worth of food."
"It's the principle. It's a man's place to protect himself, his family, his home."
"I know, Sherm, I know. You've been telling me that for years. I don't know. There's got to be a better way forward."
"There tain't no way forward, Charlesy, except to keep what you've worked hard to build."
They were quiet for several minutes as Sherman finished bandaging Charlie's arm. Charlie finally said, "I'm sorry for saying the things I said earlier, Sherm. And not just because of what just happened. I know, Charlesy, I wouldn't have come back if I didn't know you were right. About everything. I don't want to go back down that path.
I don't want to go back to that dark place. I'll tell Thea it's over tomorrow.
Sherm, do you remember the time I caught you kissing Charlotte Benoit next to the woodshed on Grandpa's farm?
Charlotte? Sherman asked.
Charlotte?
Yeah, remember? It was the afternoon before I had that fight with those hobos who wandered onto the farm after jumping from a train while it was cutting across the Northside Forest.
Oh yeah, we had a fight about it, didn't we?
We sure did.
Charlotte Benoit. I've not thought about her for years. Whatever happened to her?
She married Dr. Gerhard's son, Richter. Remember him?
Richter.
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 No, I don't.
You sure 'twas who it were?
He was tall, lanky, had that funny haircut like his father's.
Surely you remember him.
He picked a fight with you at the Flanagan about a week before we left for Messina.
Oh, yeah, Sherman began to laugh. Richter, he always thought he was so tough.
That's him.
Charlotte ended up with that guy?
Wow.
Yep,
Mrs. Richter Gerhard.
Just think, she could have been Mrs. Sherman Livernoise.
Well, how about you read me that other letter from Gloria Jane?
I'm feeling better now.
Sure thing, Charlie. Sure thing.
After Sherman had left for the day, Charlie whispered into the darkness,
I was in love with Charlotte Benoit. She never existed. She was just a figure in a dream I kept having, and I never told Sherman about her.
Charlie paused for a moment and then said, that was not Sherman Livernoise.
No, Sherman Livernoise is dead. You saw his shattered body in a makeshift morgue in France.
I know. I remember.
Are you ready to do what I tell you? We don't have much time.
Wait a minute. What's the hurry? I can't see, remember?
That's part of their lie, too. They've made you think you're hurt to keep you more easily under their control.
Charlie touched the bandages on the left side of his face and felt the sharp pain again.
Are you sure? I'm in a lot of pain when I touch that side of my face.
I'm sure. Be quiet now and listen.
The female voice commanded. There was suddenly a sharp ringing in his ears, followed by a high-pitched squeal. And then Charlie heard voices, as if on a radio.
He's still very resistant.
We need more time.
Why? If we're going to terminate him in the end, what does it matter what he believes?
We must know how the primary signal is getting through. We've spent days trying to block it, and we're still only partially successful.
I'm sure once the autopsy is completed, we'll discover how the signal reception and processing is accomplished.
Perhaps. But I also want to know if that technology is enhancing his fundamental psychological resistance to the drugs and to the diversion. He seems to be growing increasingly distrustful of the Sherman probe. Why is that? How is that? I must know as much as possible, in case we discover more situations like this. We must have more data regarding how potent this resistance is, and whether or not it could spread throughout this population. Besides, I'd rather keep him as docile as possible for as long as possible. I don't want a repeat of what happened to Clarkson. What a waste of good stock.
I understand. In the meantime, I've ordered the forward research team to exhume the grandfather's body to ascertain if there are any biological markers or inherited mutations that might explain some of this.
Good. It's unfortunate we don't have access to the father's corpse.
Yes, but the report indicates that that body was destroyed in an automobile accident.
And are you keeping the wife under surveillance?
Yes. We could have her here within 2 hours if necessary.
Excellent. Excuse me, Commander. What is it? A change of orders. We just received a priority message from Central Medical Command. We're to put down both prisoners and perform the autopsy on the rogue specimen within the hour.
The radio voices were silenced.
They're coming for you,
the female voice said.
I'll be with you in 3 minutes, and when I get there, you must do everything I tell you to do. In the meantime, pull off the bandages.
The voice and the strange feeling of another presence beside him disappeared yet again.
Pull off my bandages, Charlie whispered. Is it that simple?
He touched the sore left side of his face once more, then began to frantically claw at the bindings around his head. Before long, he managed to uncover his right eye, but the sudden flash of light from the room momentarily blinded him. He took a few seconds to collect himself, then began to pull away more of the coverings. Soon his left eye was uncovered, and he opened it just enough to assure himself that he could, in fact, still see with it. A final tug brought the whole bundle of bandages away. Charlie reached up and felt only smooth skin across his face, except for a small metal circle, like a large washer, stuck on his cheek. He tugged at it, but it would not come off, and a searing pain raced across the left side of his face and neck. "That's how they've been making you think you're in pain," the voice said, now truly beside him. Charlie squinted up against the light, then opened his eyes more widely. "You," Charlie said as he recognized the red-haired nurse from the train station in Saint-Sophie-sur-Douve. "Yes, me. I've been tracking you for weeks, Charlie Spear. The nanoprobe I inserted into your arm at the field hospital had to grow very slowly in order to avoid detection." She put her left arm under his right shoulder and helped him rise from the bed. Charlie looked around and saw that he was not in a hospital room, but was rather in an oddly elongated windowless space. Besides the bed, there was absolutely no other furniture in the room. Nanoprobe? He asked. "Yes, I implanted it when I checked your pulse that morning in the hospital. It's a tiny medical device. Once inserted, it repurposes nutrients and various biowastes in your system to expand into whatever instrument is needed. In this case, I programmed it to construct a neurotransmitter receiver microunit. It was only in the last 20 hours or so that it grew large enough to begin receiving my communications signal." "I don't understand." "You won't, not yet. Just remember, you need to do everything I say, and immediately. Our lives depend on it. And you're about to enter a much bigger world than you've ever imagined existed, Charlie Spear." They walked toward the nearest wall. Wordlessly, the red-haired woman pressed a button on a small device attached to her belt, and a portion of the wall slid soundlessly aside. They passed through the opening and into a narrow passageway made of a dark, smooth, and cold metal-like material. "Where are we?" Charlie whispered. "In a top-secret, high-security research facility several miles outside of Thurso, Scotland. There's been a core governing and research presence of one sort or another at this location for at least 6,000 years. Charlie stopped walking and looked at her. "I have no idea what you're talking about. Charlie, you were moved to a secret facility tucked away at the very edge of Scotland, away from prying eyes and snooping British officials. And I've got to get you out of here before they miss you." "Wait a minute, what about Chip? We can't leave him." "Chip Clarkson? No, we have to leave him. I don't think you understand the risk, Charlie. You are a threat to them, and they are preparing to kill you and carve your head up until they find whatever it is that is allowing you to receive the signals." "Well, that's your nano whatever." She laughed grimly. "No, you don't understand. I added the nanoprobe 3 weeks ago, but like them, I was already tracking the primary signal that was being beamed into your cranium months ago. I was just lucky our paths crossed in that train station in Saint-Sophie-sur-Douve, and they were just lucky that you saw too much on the platform. When they probed you to determine how best to erase your memory of the woman you saw, they realized you were the receiver, Charlie. Someone else is communicating with you, and I'm guessing it's been going on for quite some time. Perhaps even longer than you've realized." "The dream," Charlie whispered. "A dream, yes, it could manifest itself that way. So I've not been going crazy. On the contrary, Charlie, you've shown remarkable resilience that I'd never expect from a primitive. Sorry, I mean the uninitiated. Come on, let's go." "No, wait, we must get Chip. He saw too much too, and that was my fault. I could not live with myself knowing he died here because of me." "Charlie, we don't have time." "Well, make time." "And he's in really bad shape. He put up quite a struggle." "I'll help him." "You can barely walk." "I'll manage." "This is insane." "No more insane than the rest of my life has been for the past 3 years." In the end, the red-haired nurse relented, though she continued to sputter as they turned in a new direction and headed into a darkened wing of the facility. By this time, she had drawn two pistols from beneath her jacket and had handed one to Charlie. "It fires highly concentrated energy beams, but it works essentially like any other pistol you've ever fired. Don't hesitate to use it. They will kill you one way or another, without remorse. They turned a final corner and came to an open doorway. Chip's large frame was barely visible, lying on a table in the center of the small darkened room. Charlie stumbled in and gently pulled Chip over from his side to his back. Chip, it's Charlie Spear. Can you hear me? We've got to get out of here. Chip's face was terribly bruised and one eye was swollen shut. Dried blood was caked in his hair and across much of his face. His one eye fluttered open.
Charlie?
He whispered. Come on, bud. Charlie pulled free of the nurse's arms and gently hoisted Chip up to a sitting position. He groaned with the effort. Come on, you can do it.
No, I can't. Go on without me.
Come on, Charlie, the nurse implored. We all go together, Charlie insisted. His strength was returning, as was his spear stubbornness. Charlie wrapped his arms around Chip and pulled him from the table. The soldier's large frame nearly fell into Charlie's arms, but he gradually steadied himself and began to take faltering steps with Charlie toward the door. This is never going to work, the nurse said as Charlie slid around to Chip's side and drew his friend against his left side so that his right arm was free to use the gun. Let's go, Charlie said, a new sense of purpose entering his voice. It was slow going through the hallways. Several times they had to duck into side rooms to avoid a security detail, but so far they seemed not to have been missed, as no alarms had begun to sound. Despite his efforts to project a newfound confidence, Charlie grew tired under the burden of keeping Chip on his feet, and the strange environment was causing him a growing sense of anxiety. Hurry, hurry, the nurse said as she jogged back to them after scouting ahead through several junctures. We're about 100 meters from a service lift that will take us up three levels where there is a transport flight deck. They moved out and proceeded to the second of three junctures. As they rounded the corner, they came face to face with a small squad of guards. In the instant that the danger registered for Charlie, the nurse had fired off five shots. Two of the guards fell unconscious immediately. The others recovered from their surprise and pulled their weapons on the fleeing party. This way, she yelled, pulling Charlie with Chip back down the corridor in which they had just been. Then she pushed them forward, and the nurse turned back and fired to keep the guards at bay.
Charlie, leave me,
Chip muttered. No, I've lost enough already. I'm not leaving you behind.
I'm just about through. Give me the gun and run. I'll cover you.
No, keep moving, the nurse ordered as she fired off another shot and pushed them through an open door into a small service tunnel. She tapped a locking code into the keypad on the wall, then studied a digital map on her communications device. We're running short of escape routes, she huffed. An alarm began to ring. And now time, too. Go, she yelled. They began to make their way down the small tunnel, turning this way and that to watch for soldiers from side corridors or from the door behind. Chip's breathing was becoming worse by the moment, and Charlie was now pulling him rather than helping him to stand. Both men were about to collapse when the nurse activated a button at the end of a corridor, and a door opened to reveal a very small elevator. Get in, she ordered. Once inside, Charlie helped Chip sit down on the floor while they rode the lift up several levels. When we exit, the nurse began, we'll be about 30 meters from the entrance to the transport station. No matter what, just keep moving. Once inside, look for the large craft docked on the right-hand side, about midway down the chamber. The launch sequence is very simple. I'm sending instructions to the nanoprobe in case you have to pilot the vessel. She reached for Charlie's left hand and squeezed it hard. Remember, no matter what, Charlie, don't stop. The elevator slowed and the door began to open. Charlie helped Chip back to his feet, and then they all hurried forward. Alarms were blaring, and an angry voice was giving orders through some form of speaker system. Suddenly, five soldiers appeared in a side hallway to their left and fired. Chip took a hit in his left shoulder, and Charlie felt the heat of one bolt of energy as it narrowly missed his ear. The nurse swore and fired back. Keep moving forward, she ordered Charlie as she hunkered down in the archway, blasting at the guards who were taking cover, as best as they could, 20 feet away. Charlie gathered his strength, heaved Chip up again, and pushed forward. They reached the end of the tunnel, and the door slid open. He caught his breath as the chamber beyond came into view. It was an aircraft hangar, but it was filled with machines the likes of which he had never seen before. Charlie would have been lost in wonder, but the sound of intense firing behind him helped him focus on the task at hand. "Come on, Chip, let's keep moving."
"What the hell?"
he heard Chip mutter beside him.
"Charlie, what the hell?"
The blaster fire behind them had ceased. Looking back, Charlie saw the nurse stumbling through the doorway. She'd survived the firefight, but not without taking a bad shot to her right arm. It was hanging uselessly in front of her now, and she had abandoned her weapon in the tunnel behind them. "Keep going, Charlie," she yelled, waving them on with her left hand. "Get on board. Yes, that large ship to your right." Charlie passed three smaller vehicles. As advanced as they were, it was clear to him that each was intended for a single passenger or pilot. But the vessel she had pointed toward was much larger, with an ample crew component accessed by a ramp that was now folded outward toward the hangar floor. Charlie was about to start up the ramp with Chip when a tall figure appeared from the far side of the vessel, a large rifle-like weapon aimed directly at them. Its body was covered with a thin, partially transparent, black-colored fabric through which integrated mechanical replacements, extensions, and augmentations were visible. But the face. Charlie could not believe what he was seeing. This had once been Sherman Livernoise, but the left eye socket was empty. Portions of the left cheek had been sewn back together after having been sliced apart. His left ear was missing. Parts of his skull that had been blown away in the battle in Saint-Sophie-sur-Duve had been replaced with a milky white translucent material. "Charlie," the Sherman probe said softly, "everything will be fine. Just lower your weapon and wait there." "Shoot it!" the nurse yelled from behind them. "Shoot it now! That is not Sherman Livernoise!" Charlie raised his weapon as tears rolled down his cheeks. "Charlie," the Sherman probe said simply, smiling. "It's me." As Corporal Spear hesitated, a group of soldiers appeared from another entrance to the left and fired on them. The nurse shouted out as she was struck again, and she fell to the floor with a grunt of pain. "No!" Charlie yelled. Chip grabbed the pistol from Charlie and fired at the Sherman probe. Several energy bolts pummeled its right shoulder, and it stumbled backward. "Stop!" Charlie yelled at Chip. Chip pulled free and stumbled back toward the fallen nurse.
"Charlie, help me!"
he yelled. And then a shadow moved across the top of the ramp in the crew compartment. Corporal Charlie Spear looked up to see a figure dressed all in black, its head hidden behind a black helmet, just like his spectral nemesis. "That's far enough," the figure said as it leveled another large rifle at Charlie's head. This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.